Hi, my name is Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. Well, I usually don't know what I'm ever going to say whenever I speak. It's been a long time. I guess I'll just start from the beginning. I come from a family on both sides, my mother and my father's side. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother has lots of brothers and sisters that were alcoholic, and we were both very big families. I'm an only child, and my parents were divorced when I was three, so I was brought up with a single mother. So basically, we were raising ourselves eventually. It became like we were more sisters and mother and daughter kind of thing. And there was a few things that happened during my childhood that I could blame for my alcoholism, but I really don't think it was one thing or another. I had been molested when I was 5 years old, and I used to think that maybe that's why, you know. But I came to believe and realize that that was maybe more my intimacy issues as I got older. That played a part in that, but the alcoholism was pretty much from the get-go, I think. I was, you know, I came by honesty from both sides of the family. I had my first drink when I was nine. I remember being babysat. Mom was very young, and she was going out and partying too, you know, like she was in her 20s, and you know, she was going out trying to find Mr. Wright to take care of the two of us. And at that point, it was very geared in people's heads, especially women, I guess, to have a man in your life and to have someone take care of you. And my mom was kind of wanting that. So she would go out and she'd do her thing. And I was with babysitters, you know, on weekends. And my babysitters wanted to party too, right, because they're in their late teens. So I would dress up and go with my friends, my babysitters to these parties. And of course there was drinking and people puking and, you know, people drunk and crying because it's teenager drinking, right, at a house party. So if you remember what that was like, that was what it was like. So this is what I was exposed to at a very young age. And I drank too, you know, like I take a bottle and someone else, you know, put it down and I know they just took a sip out of it and opened it and I try it. And it seemed like chaos, but it was fun at the same time, all this stuff going on. It was very exciting, you know, for a nine-year-old. And my first real, like, drunk was 11. I was with another babysitter, and she had a house party, and I ended up being the little bartender behind the bar, serving the drinks. And I was just making up concoctions and all kinds of stuff. And I liked it. And it made me feel like I was a part of the whole thing because I was important. You know, I was getting attention. You know, people were, you know, like it was like I was young, but yet I was always trying to fit in and be a part of. And, you know, at 11 years old, it's not normal to be bartending behind the bar in the basement of your friend's farmhouse, you know, while all her friends are drinking and getting drunk. And the funny thing is I got really drunk, the first time I ever got really drunk, and I ended up taking care of my babysitter and hauling her up the stairs and putting her in a shower with all her clothes on. So that was my first experience with getting drunk. And it just kind of evolved from there. I just became, I grew up very, very fast, and was trying to be a woman very fast because I wanted to grow up. I didn't want to be young. I wanted to have fun and party with everybody else. And the younger kids bored me, and the things they did bored me. And it was just when you're exposed to that kind of lifestyle, it's kind of, you can get caught up in it, right? I think I started living the life of maybe a 20-year-old when I was about 13. I had a boyfriend that was a senior in high school. Back in Ontario, where I'm from, Cornwall, Ontario, our high school used to go to grade 13. And we had, like, elementary up to grade 6, then junior high, and then high school. And I was in junior high, going to be going to high school, and my boyfriend was just coming out of high school, and he was a bass player in a band. And some of you guys remember the band Duran Duran. That's what they kind of looked like, and I thought they were just the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know. And I started dating him, and he was my first boyfriend, and I was with him for 2 years. He was my first everything, my first lover, my first, I waited a year before I slept with him because I wanted to be special, you know. I had some brains back then. And it was a nice relationship, but of course it ended because we were young and he was going to college and I was still in high school and it just didn't work out, but I was heartbroken. But I had been exposed to, you know, the whole drug scene and the bar scene and the bands and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, here I am 15 years old, looking the same way as I do now, maybe a bit thinner, and, you know, and living that kind of lifestyle, a party girl Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. I knew all the bars in town in Cornwall. I knew all the owners. Nobody knew how old I was. They all assumed I was like 19 or 20, and nobody ever asked because I was associated with a lot of people who were, you know, owners of different things and stuff, and they never would have assumed that I was that young. And I played the game very well. I was a chameleon, right? Different, depending on what group of people I was with, I took on that color, whatever. If I was with people who were kind of stoners, I would take on the stoner kind of, you know. And if I was with very, very upper-class people, upper scale, then I would take that on and so on and so on. During this time, I was in high school and didn't like high school because it was boring. And so I quit when I was 16. I told my mom, I'm going to quit. I had a job, and I said, I'm going to quit high school. I don't want to be here anymore. And she was like, well, I guess I'll sign the papers, and if you think that's what you have to do. And she was still living that lifestyle. So we were both bar hopping. And sometimes I would see her in the bar, and I'd wave at her, and I'd walk out of the bar like, you know what I mean? Like, hi, Mom. Okay, I'm going to go to another bar tonight because you're here. And she would just, I didn't have any, how do you say that? We were like sisters. We weren't like mother and daughter, so I didn't really have a lot of discipline, ever. I was never hit. I was never grounded. I lived the life of an adult. We lived like roommates in the house kind of thing. So that's how I was. You know, I never had anybody tell me what to do. And when they did, I was basically, yeah, sorry. I don't listen to anybody. I do what I want, when I want, with who I want, and that was it. And my thing was is that I never hurt anybody. So I'm not hurting anybody, so I'm okay, you know. After I ended up breaking it off with my first boyfriend, there was quite a few years of lots of sexual gallivanting and experimenting because it was like a big smorgasbord of, wow, you know, the drinking, the bars, the nightlife, the coke, the this, the that, everything was there for me and very accessible. So, you know, I did all that stuff. But I knew that I was alcoholic. I had a very good suspicion that I was alcoholic when I was about 16. And my mother and my new stepfather at the time, this is the scenario, and this is the first time I really kind of clicked that I had a problem, you know, because it was all fun and games before. I was 16. I was at Pedro's Pub in Cornwall. My friend Brian Edwardson owned it, and we were a whole bunch of people on a Saturday afternoon sitting outside on the patio. Long Island iced teas, Obut en masse, just coming. And my mom came with her girlfriend and had a drink. And then they said, well, why don't we go for lunch? And I was like, oh, no, I can't go for lunch. I hadn't eaten anything yet. It was like maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I hadn't eaten anything yet. And I wasn't hungry because I knew if I'd eat that it would get in the way of me catching this buzz or this euphoria that I really liked to have. Wasn't necessarily the taste of alcohol for me. It was how it made me feel. I hear different people over the years say different things were there, you know what I mean? For me, it wasn't the taste of it. It was the feeling that it made me feel. So I stayed there, and I drank Long Island iced teas all afternoon with a whole bunch of people. And all I remember is partying in the bar afterwards. And then that's it. And it was a blank. I woke up the next morning with bruises all over my knees and my mom kind of coming in the room looking at me. And she's like, "Do you know what happened last night?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you passed out at your friend's at the bar, and we had to go get you. One of your friends called us, at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we have to go and get you." And I was still in this hangover kind of stage of feeling like I was there but not there. And the kind of look that I had, the look that she was giving me was like a very kind of concerned and disappointed look, you know, because all the other years that I'd been drinking and partying, none of these things happened. You know what I mean? Like, that's probably why she never said anything about it, because she was doing it, I was doing it, and it didn't cause a conflict. I was still doing school. I was, you know, doing what I was supposed to do. So it didn't cause a conflict, but this time it did. And it progressed from there. My life became just kind of like, you know, looking forward to the next going out and partying, because I didn't really like myself. There was part of me that really liked myself and part of me that didn't like myself at all. There was the shame, the guilt, you know, the abandonment, the rejection. I went through a lot of things with my father and a lot of men that my mom had dated over the years that got attached to people and then they left. And my father as well was basically a deadbeat dad and made lots of promises and never kept them. And I hung on to those things. And I always blame myself too, thinking that how come he doesn't love me or how come he's not, what's wrong with me? And I had been molested too. So that added a lot of very, excuse my language, but fucked up ideas about intimacy and love and sex and men and what my role was with them and what their role was supposed to be with me. And that just carried on through, you know. I would put myself in positions where I was the prey of these, you know, of different situations of men, and I was also the predator. And I was hunting them down because it was a challenge and it was a game for me, you know, to play the game of the dating and the flirting and all this kind of stuff. It gave me a rush, you know, which was what I wanted. Other than the alcohol, it gave me a rush in itself, feeling like you have power or control over someone, but it's only a sexual power or control. It's not that the person really cares about you or respects you. It's just that they, you know, basically want to get into your pants. And that's it. I quit school, as I said. I went to, I started managing a clothing store and got into modeling and doing all kinds of things like that. And there was just many different reoccurring situations like the one when I was 16, you know. Getting drunk, doing things irresponsibly, going to work, still drunk in the morning, you know what I mean, and having to take care of the store and my staff and so on and so on. And just never feeling really right. And that's a common denominator that I hear over and over in the meetings, is that nobody ever felt right. I don't know what that means to feel right or whatever, but I know how I felt, and I just never felt like I was a square peg putting it in a round, you know, round circle kind of thing. Wanted to go to college. I had went through, my mom had moved here from Cornwall to be with her, my stepfather, and I wanted to go with them because I didn't like Cornwall. I'd done a lot of things in other cities and stuff, Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, and I wanted to move into the big city and get out of Cornwall because I didn't fit in there, you know. So I moved with them. I actually decided to go back to school, and then I had been involved with someone in Cornwall right before I had left, and this was my first hostage, basically. I was 18 at the time, and he was 27, and I moved back to Cornwall to be with him. I left Montreal and all that kind of stuff to be with this guy, And it was just toxic from the start. He was very, even though he was 27, he was more like 16, you know, as far as mentality-wise. So we were right on track, the two of us, you know. The games, the, you know, the drinking, and all the crap that goes along with it, the jealousy. That lasted for about 2 years. And I basically, you know, ended the relationship because once anything got difficult for me, I'd quit. With friends, I had lots of fair weather friends. I think some of us can relate to that during our drinking days, that people kind of came in and out of my life. And I didn't really care because I knew I could find some more people to drink with or some more people to party with. And I really didn't have a lot of substance or meaning within myself. I knew I was basically a good person, but I didn't have a lot of substance. I was just a little girl in a woman's body floating around trying to find somebody to love or to love me. Basically, that was it in a nutshell. And trying to have attention, you know, and all of these things. I ended up moving back to Cornwall, living with him for a year, and then throwing all of his stuff out the window, you know, out of the balcony and all that, you know, the major drama queen thing, and moved back to Montreal with my parents. And I said, you know what, I really need to go to school. I need to go to school. I want to get my, you know, everybody's telling me over the years, you're so smart, you know, why, what are you doing? You know, you quit high school, you're so intelligent. And I said, because I was bored and I couldn't study and get cut into my partying, you know, and I couldn't party because I had to study and do homework. So I had decided to go back to adult ed and get my my high school diploma, and then I decided to apply to college, to university for social work, because I thought that I had lots of stuff to pass on to other people. I was always trying to help everybody. I was always able to give other people answers, but I couldn't help myself, which is easy for a lot of people to do, I guess. So I did. I went and went to college and stayed there about 2 years, almost 2 years. And during that time, that's when I hit my bottom. Well, one of my bottoms. I was in college and it was fun and I liked what I was learning and I liked helping people and I worked at the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal and worked with teens and all kinds of stuff and I really thought I'd found my niche. But during the process of this helping thing and learning about people's, you know, psychological problems and all this, I learned about alcoholism and I learned about drug abuse and I learned about mental disorders and I learned about all these things through all, you know, my courses. And I started realizing that how the hell am I being authentic to these people if I'm not helping myself and I have a problem here? I'm sitting here helping these people, but I'm not being authentic because I have problems, major problems that I keep pushing under the rug and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, relationships, these types of things with men, I got very caught up in them most of the time and allowed them to kind of rule what I was doing. So if it wasn't booze, it was a relationship. It was very insidious, the two of them, you know, together. So I basically decided to quit school and to, I don't remember exactly what it was. It was just the fact that I felt like a big, fat liar to myself and to everybody else. And I kind of felt like there's a lot more to my life. I could do a lot more with my life. I could be the person that I'm trying to be on the corner stool, at, you know, as the barfly, the, you know, sitting there looking all prim and proper and pretty, thinking that I'm having this air about myself, you know, that that nobody can see the pain through me. But there was a lot of pain and a lot of embarrassment and shame and all the things that come along with the things that we do during our alcohol, well, during our addictions and some of the things that happened before I even became addicted to alcohol and to relationships and stuff, you know, a love addiction. in love with the idea of being in love, but really didn't know what really love was, you know. There was all kinds of things that I wanted to do and wanted to be, and I never knew what I wanted. I'm a singer, and I've always been a singer and dancer since I was very young, and never did anything with it because I was too busy partying to do anything with it. Sang in a few bars and stuff like that, but really never got my shit together, you know. I ended up going to Downsview, Ontario. I put myself into a place called the Renaissance House for Women, and it's a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. And I don't even remember how old I was. Maybe I was 24, 25. I'm 35 now. Yeah, I was about 24. I had just turned 24, and stayed there for 30 days. It was a whirlwind of all kinds of information and lots of other screwed up women, and we all have different stories and backgrounds, but I really realized that we had a lot in common. And if it's not the life, like if there wasn't the life style we had in common, it was the emotions that I could identify with these girls and they could identify with me, whether they were 60 or whether they were, you know, younger than me. It didn't matter who they were. I could identify every time they opened their mouth to the emotions that they were feeling at the time, and I was feeling the same way, because I used to always think I was different, right? Never fit in, different, you know, a little eccentric, whatever, and I kind of carried that with me within the fellowship, and you know, I would compare, well, I don't drink like that, and I don't drink like this, so maybe I'm not an alcoholic, which caused complications later on, because I did slip for a while. Went to a meeting, you know, went out to a bar, went to a meeting. You know, it was kind of like the first 2 years of my sobriety was wandering around aimlessly, going to meetings, sitting on a chair, listening, hanging out with a lot of people, but not working the program, not working the steps, not really doing what the meat of the program is. It's kind of like half doing something, half that. And a lot of people do that. And some people think that that works for them, but for me it didn't, because I was slipping and sliding and lying to myself, because once the seed is planted and you've done all that work and you've been to an AA meeting, there's a good reason why you were at an AA meeting. If you're in an AA meeting for any reason whatsoever, you've got addiction problems, and that's it. I mean, that's my experience. Nobody comes to a meeting because they think they have a problem. It's pretty likely that you do if you're sitting here right now. But I own my own stuff and I have a problem. Lots of stuff. But I'm working on them. It took me a good 2 years to get it. I'm 10 and a half years sober now, and for the first 2 years of my sobriety I'd get 6 months. I'd go out one night and go to a meeting the next day and cry, you know, on whoever was available at the time, whatever friend I had, because even in the fellowship for a long time, I still lived the life of being a bar person. Fair weather friends, if they were convenient, they were there. If they weren't, well, you know, and didn't really let anybody really know who I was, because I was so busy playing the game and trying to be someone I wasn't. I wasn't sure who I was, right? Because I had played so many roles, I didn't know who I was, really. But I had it. There was always that little light or that sense of, I don't know if you guys ever experienced it, but when I was, like, let's say I was in a bar and, you know, I was drunk at this point, past the point of that nice euphoria that I used to want, I'd be in the bathroom and I'd be trying to make myself sick so that I could go and drink again with everybody else, and the party would continue, because I never wanted the party to end, right? I wanted the music and the nice-looking guys and everybody pretty and everything looks nice, and that's what I wanted. I never wanted it to end. So I would be in the bathroom trying to make myself sick so that I could continue to drink with everybody and party. And I remember many times thinking, oh, God, if you just, you know, help me stay a little bit sober tonight and I don't do anything wrong, you know, please, I'll get better. I won't drink this or mix with that. And it was like all this really twisty thinking, really screwed up, you know. And crying sometimes saying, you know, like, if I only had this and if I only had that, maybe I wouldn't be so lonely and maybe I wouldn't be here and all this kind of stuff. And but there was always that that light there. There was always somebody watching over me. There was always something there. Because no matter how far down I got in situations, I've heard a lot of people say that they were suicidal, and I can relate to that, but I never, something was there for me that I never got to the point where I felt like I wanted to end my life. My life really sucked, and I didn't know where to turn a lot of the times, and I, you know, felt depression and anxiety and all kinds of different things. But there was always something there kind of keeping me going. I think it was the possibility of having the kind of life that I have right now today, sitting up here. I wasn't meant to go anywhere, and I wasn't meant to kill myself, and I wasn't meant to live that kind of life anymore, you know? None of us are. None of us are. I slipped and I skipped for 2 years, and you know, tried to have relationships, and knew damn well that I would never be able to have a relationship with anybody until I loved myself first. And I knew who I was, right? What I stood for. My morals and my values would go as the wind blows. Whoever I was with at the time, I was trying to fit in and please everyone, right? So it didn't. I didn't really have my own set of core values or who I was. So I just took on everybody else's. When I say chameleon, I literally mean that. I took on other people's lives and their situation and made up stories and lied. You know what I mean? To fit in and make myself look like this big madame. You have to when you're 15 and you're trying to fit into a group of people who are 25, 26 years old and nobody knows how old you are. You have to lie. You have to lie. You have to. I didn't have to, but that's where my life led me, and that's where I took myself, you know? There was a point where second last slips in the 2 years, I had actually, there's a lot of pressure on taking chips. I don't know if anybody feels that, especially your first year chip. There's a lot of pressure for some reason because, yeah, and you put it on yourself because, you know, you have a group of people who you hang with now and they're like, yes, you've got a year, it's good, things are going to get better. You're feeling, like, really good and you're not seeing what the possibilities are of all the pitfalls, you know. You just lost. You're going around doing the best you can. If you hook up with the right kind of people, you do. I didn't necessarily. They were just as lost and even worse than I was, but they were sober. And I thought maybe they have the answer. Maybe I can hang on to them because they have 10 years or 5 years, you know. And that's bullshit because it doesn't matter how many years you have. It's how you work the program because there's a lot of sick people in the rooms, and there's a lot of sick people out there, and that's life. That's the reality. You're not going to be all safe and everything in here. The only thing that I'm sure of is that there are a lot of people who can relate to me. What's going on or their intention in their mind, I have no idea. I have to get to know them. So my trust got tested a lot in the fellowship, which made me grow and become stronger and get a set of values that I didn't have before and opinions and ideas. Something I want to share that actually I haven't shared for a few years is that I was coming up on a year chip, and 2 days before the year chip or a week before the year chip, I went and I drank a bottle of wine. And that's where my head was at. And I felt so guilty, and I felt so much pressure to take this chip, and I felt like I was such a loser and that I had failed, that I actually got up and took a year chip, and I had drank the year before, or the week before. That's how much pressure I felt to take this damn chip. It's a big deal to take one of these things. You might, but there's a reason for 12-step reps. And when you have one of these, it's an important thing. It's a symbol of something, and that's how I looked at it eventually. But at the beginning, it just didn't mean anything. I was going through the motions and trying to please people. So I took a year chip, and I had drank a week before, and that was the biggest lie that I could ever do, and I was sober. So that just goes to show you where my head was at. I wasn't very healthy after a year. I was just, you know, there's this big ball and it's full of smoke and it's like taking a little pin and poking it and it slowly clears and the fog lifts, but it takes a long freaking time for that fog to lift, let me tell you. From my experience anyway, it's still there sometimes and it still comes back. The stinking thinking and the twisty head thing, but it doesn't last as long. So that's what I did, and a few weeks later I had to admit it, and it was really hard for me, and I was crying, and I just felt like a total loser, and, you know, and then someone came up to me and said, if you didn't do what you had done, you'd just be cured, and we'd all be cured, and there wouldn't be slippers, and there wouldn't be meetings, and this is the sickness. These are the insidious, the sickness, the monkey on my back that sits there and waits for me to be vulnerable, and it preys on our spirits and our souls to make us feel like we're less than and we're not important, to have that life that we could have if we really wanted it, and to work on it, because I fight with that. Still, you know, do I deserve this? Am I worthy? Am I good enough? And I'm more critical on myself than I am on anyone else. I'm more judgmental towards myself than I am on anyone else. Impatient, intolerant. My last drunk was 10.5 years ago, and it was on the day before Thanksgiving. And I wasn't very thankful, obviously. I was feeling sorry for myself. And thinking about the past and living in the past and regretting the past and worrying about tomorrow and the week later and being hard on myself that I wasn't where I was supposed to be at that point in my life and I was a failure and all these things. And not living in the moment. And then I went out and I drank and I got really, really drunk. And it felt like crap. And I remember when I was first getting sober in those 2 years that I remember, you know, you wake up in the morning and those birds, the birds, you wake up in the morning and you go outside and you're not really, you didn't even sleep, what am I saying, waking up. You go outside and everybody's life, you know, there's babies being pushed in a carriage, girls my age having kids, getting married, all this kind of stuff, and here I am, still drunk, coming out of, you know, partying at someone's house, a friend's house or something, and going, how come I can't be like that? How come that's not where I'm at, you know? And feeling really lost and alone and desperate at those times and saying, I'm never going to do this again. I don't want to feel like this again, ever, you know? And that's what happened on Thanksgiving. I kind of did that whole thing. And got some sleep that night and woke up on Thanksgiving Day and had to go out with the family, and we have a very big family, and do Thanksgiving, which is a ritual that we do, tradition. And I was hungover. There's a lot of drinking that goes on in my family. There still is a lot of drinking. But at that point, I guess it was just enough. I had had enough. Everybody has their point. And for me, that was my last time, was Thanksgiving. And it hasn't been an easy road. It's been 10.5 years of life and failed relationships and people dying in the family, and life goes on, you know. Sobriety is not easy, but it's really worth it because I'm so much more at peace with myself and happy with the person that I'm becoming, happy with the woman that I'm becoming, the friend that I'm becoming, the possible wife or lover that I'm becoming, a spirit member, all of those things, daughter. It's a pretty amazing thing. And there's a lot of, like, you know, cliches in AA, and a lot of people kind of go, oh, yeah. But they're real. They're not, this stuff is not just made up. It works. There's a lot of people, you know, that struggle within the fellowship, and we choose our path. We do have a choice. I'm not the little girl that's a victim anymore of everybody else around me and my circumstance. I have the only power I have is the power to react to my situation, to take action. And out of all the things that I have felt powerless over, but the big one was myself. And now I feel like I have more power over myself because I have a higher power. Whatever that is, that could be the tree on me. Whatever you look at as being a higher power, that's cool with me. As long as it works for you, I don't really give a shit. I don't care. Do what you have to do. Yeah, I've hit a lot of very heavy, heavy, heavy bottoms in sobriety. Some of them even harder and worse being sober because I don't have anywhere to run anymore. I can't run away from myself. Wherever I go, there I am. I try the geographical clears in and out of sobriety. Running to relationships, running to different jobs. And they never worked because all the answers were in here. And having faith in something other, having faith in myself and giving my faith and giving it up to something else, sometimes just surrendering that everything's going to be okay. I still have lots of twisty moments, and that's normal. That's life. I don't compare myself to anyone else, and I don't compare anyone else to myself. And I was, you know, when I was younger, I was very judgmental. And, you know, the typical petty woman kind of thing, oh, you know, she dressed like this and she does this and this, that. Never looked at myself, you know, because when you're pointing fingers, there's always three pointing back at yourself. I heard that in AA a long time ago, and it is true. Now I try to be as open-minded as I can be with all situations, and it's not perfect, but I have so much patience and tolerance now that I didn't have before, ever. I would have never imagined that my life would be as good as it is, considering all the bad things that have happened to me in sobriety. I've had 5 car accidents in 8 years. 2 of them I should have been dead. None of them were my fault. They were other people hitting me. And the last one was before Christmas, and I hit black ice, and I totaled my car. And I lived, which was very, very amazing. And people tell me, oh, my God, you're so unlucky. And I said, no, I'm lucky because I should have been dead a few times. If not when I was drinking and out with my buddies, drinking and driving, by all these accidents that happened to me. I have no idea why these accidents happened to me. And I was feeling sorry for myself for a long time. I have permanent damage on my jaw and my neck from another accident before this one. But you know what? It doesn't really matter because I'm here. I work at the Royal Victoria Hospital and work in different hospitals, and I see a lot of people, accidents, losing legs and this and that, and it just the whole ball of wax, and I just look at myself and I say, shit, you know, you're so lucky. I'm like, oh, I'm not married. I don't have a husband. Everybody asks me, how come you're not married by now? And I'm like, who cares now? You know what I mean? I'm alive. I'm good. Why do I even used to worry about that stuff? You know, I don't need to be in a relationship to be happy. I have a relationship with myself, and I can hang out with guys and girls, and it doesn't have to be a sexual thing. I'm okay with that, and I'm okay with myself now. I've went through depressions. I've went through sufferings, anxiety attacks from these accidents, fear of driving because someone else is going to come up and hit me after 5 times. But last week, after my last accident happened December 9th. I had just gone back to work from the last accident for three weeks, and I had hit black ice and got into another accident, and I'd been off work for a year and a half, and I had just gone back to work in 3 weeks, and another accident happened, and I was just like, I was blown away. My life had just been taken so many times and turned upside down, and I was just like, what is this? Like, what? But this time, for some reason, compared to the other times, I don't know if practice makes perfect, but it seemed to be that I took this really well, considering. And it brought me to a lot of different places. I drove for the first time last week since the accident, and I wasn't nervous. I didn't feel panic attacks. So I was really like, yeah, okay. Doesn't mean I'm going to be driving all the time. It just means that's good that I got into the car, because I don't want to let it, you know, lick me, kind of thing. And lots of things have happened in the evolution of all these accidents that are very positive things. I don't really know how to explain it. I just know that life's okay, you know, and even when it's not okay, I have the rooms to go to. There was a stint of time that I was sober, but I didn't go to meetings because I, you know, did that whole resentment thing, and I'm not getting anything out of meetings anymore, and every time I go to a meeting, I'm feeling resentful for some reason or this and that, and that was my path, and I stopped going to meetings for a while. That was what I did. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. If you're thinking about doing it, it's really hard to live life without hooking up at least once a week when you've been sober a while, at least to stay connected to the fellowship, because your mind and your spirit can go off to many different places that I didn't have to go to, but I had to take the road less traveled, right? Because that's what I did when I was drinking, and that's what I did in my sobriety. But meetings are very important. Getting a sponsor is very important. Talking to people and don't worry about what people think. Just be yourself. And there are people that are going to judge you. And if you're a slipper or whatever, or if you are a very special character and you're sober, there are people that are going to judge you, but there's a lot of people that aren't going to. So we're here to find out who we are and to be happy and to better get. I came and got sober and did what I had to do to get a better quality of life, because I knew that I could attain that if I stopped drinking. I just didn't know when or how it was going to happen. And it has happened, and it's continuing to happen. And I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. I'm in a good place in my life, and I'm at a very good stage in my life, because I am, as I said a few times, very comfortable in my own skin, and I found out who the essence of Stephanie is, not who my friends thought I was supposed to be, or my boyfriend, or, you know, I'm really being honest with myself and everyone else now. It's not a game, there's no show, I'm not trying to be, you know, Madame. I'm just who I am, and if you like me, great. If you don't, that's okay too, you know. My relationship with my mother has evolved, and we're very, very close, and we've gotten rid of all the baggage and the bad stuff from the past. We've totally opened the floodgates and talked and screamed and yelled and swore at each other and everything, like the whole kit and caboodle, really big, heavy-duty stuff, but it's all out now. Because this is something that I really take to heart in the program, that I had heard when I first started coming around, and it was, you're only as sick as the secrets that you keep. Because that's what kept me drinking, was I wasn't being honest with myself, and I wasn't being honest with other people about really who I was and what I was about. And once you let that go, you're going to feel so much lighter. And you can do that at any time. You can do a house cleaning any time. It doesn't matter if you're new or old or whatever. You can be honest. You really can. I'm learning how to do that, and it's made me feel a lot better about myself and my sobriety. And I don't know where my life is going to go. I kind of have ideas of what I would like, you know, but and that whole thing of the relationship that I always wanted, you know, that's a part of reality. We all have problems with relationship, and a lot of us, if we're in these rooms, we have intimacy problems too. Most of us do. For some reason or another, we have those. It's hard enough as being a normal person out there having relationships, and then we have all this other crap that we have going on in our heads in here. But I guess I've come to the acceptance of the fact that if I was given the right person before, I would have never been ready for a relationship anyway with anyone, because I wasn't healthy enough to sustain something that was long-lasting and worth it. And if that happens, that's fine. If it doesn't, that's fine too. It doesn't identify who I am. It doesn't make me who I am to be someone's girlfriend or someone's wife or someone's mother. I get to play all those roles with my friends and my family and stuff, and it's okay for me. You know, it used to be a big issue with me, but now it's okay. Basically, I'm going to end it there. I just want to say that even though I don't know very many of you people, and maybe other people have said this, but I mean this. I can relate to whatever you're feeling, and I'm not bullshitting you. If you're struggling and stuff, I really have probably felt the same emotions, not went through the same situation, but felt the same emotions. And they're all warranted, and I wouldn't minimalize anything that anybody's going through, because you're all justified in feeling the pain that you feel, but you're also justified in having fun and laughing and having a good life. And that's what we want, that's what I want, is to have a good life and be happy. And that's what I want for everyone else, too. And on that note, I'm going to say adieu. Thank you.